This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Sean Strube has been living with HIV for more than three decades. He's an activist best known as the first openly HIV-positive person to run for U.S. Congress and the founder of PAWS magazine. But his new memoir goes behind the scenes of his activism. It is a deeply personal account that provides new insight into the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Strube details his life as a young political junkie and a closeted world of powerful gay men in D.C. He tells stories about the trauma of the first years of the epidemic and assesses what's happening today. He argues that issues of stigma are worse now than they've ever been. The memoir is called Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. Sean Strube is with me now. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You call the memoir Body Counts. Tell us about that title and how it relates to your story.
In the process of writing the memoir, of course, there was a lot of reflection and examination of my own life and, you know, very personal issues. And I came to the realization that a central theme in my life has really been around control and sovereignty for my own body, both, you know, as a child and abuse experiences that I deal with. Struggling to sort of possess my body from a church that felt like it owned it, for sexual freedoms, to be comfortable in it, against the virus, against the treatments, and then, of course, the double entendre of just the tremendous loss that, you know, so many of us experienced at the height of the epidemic.
You grew up in Iowa City, which is a place of great intellectual ferment. Tell us about growing up there.
You know, I say that the most fortunate thing that of my life was the zip code where I was born. That growing up in a community with, you know, excellent public schools and you know, with a great university and sort of being influenced by that, I think that we lived near the university campus, and my paper routes, I had several paper routes as a kid, led to a great influence on me of a lot of the people on my paper route who were politically progressive and were engaged and involved in things that, you know, I wouldn't have experienced through my, you know, own immediate family. So I love Iowa City still. You know, as a child, I remember, you know, in the fifth grade wearing a black armband to school and kind of getting in trouble for that and sneaking out of the house to go down to the Pentecost to watch the anti-war demonstrations. And really, my introduction to politics and my interest in politics sort of came through a feminist perspective, because that's what I was surrounded with. That's what, you know, the consciousness that I was exposed to when I first started reading a newspaper and kind of paying attention to the news.
You are also raised Catholic. How did that affect your perceptions?
You know, in ways good and bad. I mean, I was raised Catholic. My mother was orphaned as a two-year-old and raised largely by nuns and in convents and schools and so on. My three sisters' first names are all Mary because of my father's devotion to the Virgin. And when I was 13, I briefly thought I had a calling to the priesthood, and I went to a Jesuit boarding school for high school. The priesthood thing didn't work out so well, but I was exposed to the social justice aspect of Catholicism and, you know, the concept of service and its importance, and including, as I write about in the book, you know, the obligation to confront the church when that becomes necessary. So, you know, I had to kind of crawl through a sort of thick blanket of Catholicism to really take possession of my body and my sexuality and, you know, overcome the shame that it imposes on so many. But I also benefited from exposure to other values of the church that are quite admirable.
You went to Washington, D.C. as a 17-year-old with one of the jobs that anybody interested in politics at the age of 17 would have loved to have. Tell us about it.
Well, you called me a political junkie in the introduction, and if I was a political junkie, that job in Washington was like living in a contact high all day long. It was a job running an elevator in the U.S. Senate. And it was a senator's only elevator. So all day long, my elevator was only occupied by members of Congress and VIPs visiting the Capitol. and I thought I was at the center of the universe. It was very exciting. It was also the spring of 1976, which was just past the Vietnam War, just past the Watergate crisis, the bicentennial year. So Washington was all cleaned up with the bicentennial logo, and there was kind of a festive, you know, celebratory, sense. And Jimmy Carter was running for president, you know, promising, "I will never lie to you," which was, you know, considered kind of novel and new at the time. You know, I was not just a political junkie. I was idealistic, and I sort of came to Washington at a period when it felt like we were in an era of national renewal, getting past this awful war and this constitutional crisis in Watergate. Looking back now, we see it was, you know, sort of a window closing on liberalism for a generation, but I didn't know that at the time.
Sean Strube is with me. His new book is Body Counts. He's talking with me about it today on The State of Things. But you were there, again, running the elevator for the senators only, and then you became exposed to a group of elected officials who were leading double lives. Tell us about it.
When I first started becoming sexually active, and the first men I met, you know, were all other people, you know, in politics in Washington, and it was this sort of ultra-closeted world that was both fascinating and exciting as I was discovering my own sexuality. But I also quickly became disturbed by the hypocrisies that were so apparent. At that time, the oppression of the closet was so great that, you know, the social circles had nothing to do with political ideology. You could be the, you know, raving homophobe and be doing awful, horrific, destructive things by day, and in the evening, you know, be at a private party with, you know, with others who are politically progressive. That wasn't thought of as unusual. You know, your private life had nothing to do with politics, but it did for me. And I think I was part of a younger post-Stonewall generation that was starting to recognize that and be disturbed by that.
But it was creating great tension for you. And in fact, you write about sort of trying to talk yourself out of it and seeing that you could be successful and remain in the closet.
True. That was sort of a stage where I saw these people who, you know, some of them were elected officials or had, you know, very important positions and yet had this private life and with varying degrees of effort, you know, put into keeping it private, but generally pretty considerable. So, you know, briefly, I saw that as a path, right, that I could have this private life and then, you know, continue to have a career that might ultimately become more public if I ever ran for office, and that my private life wasn't anybody else's business, which it certainly isn't in one way. But in another way, particularly for, you know, people in public positions or in politics or elected positions, there can be a hypocrisy there. And I quickly knew that I wasn't going to be able to cope with that.
And there was a turning point, and you write about that in your book.
That was really when San Francisco Supervisor Harvey Milk was assassinated in 1978. I was shocked, as everyone was, and I, you know, just inhaled the media coverage at the time. I actually remember seeing the headline on the Washington Star, an afternoon newspaper in Washington back then. I said at one of my sessions speaking to students, I said, you know, there used to be newspapers in the afternoon. And somebody in the audience said, "What's a newspaper?" But I remember
I'm
seeing
laughing,
the headline.
But that's so sad. Go ahead.
But then in reading the coverage, the reference to Harvey Milk being gay was kind of a throwaway line. It was presented as like an only in San Francisco, like, isn't this kind of a weird, peculiar, you know, thing? And of course, the primary focus was on Mayor Moscone. But I just was so bothered by the failure to recognize what his election meant to so many, LGBT people, you know, all over the country, all over the world. It diminished it in a way that really made me angry.
Well, it's interesting because it seems to me there are two responses you can have. The one you had. The other is to affirm your decision to remain closeted. It isn't safe to let people know, right? And that wasn't obvious to you in the moment.
I think by then I was, you know, I had spent so much time doing a risk analysis. You know, if I came out, how would, and actually, by the way, that was also just a few weeks after I came out to my parents, which was a huge milestone, you know, that after that happened, that was, so I was by then moving into a stage where, you know what, if people find out, they find out. If that meant that I can't have this job or I can't, you know, pursue that path that I might have anticipated in my life, I knew there would be plenty of other opportunities available to me. And shortly after, Harvey Milk was killed, I moved from Washington, and I really was moving away from that intense closet that I found so oppressive. And I moved to New York, where I was meeting all sorts of people who were openly gay in a whole different, you know, kind of world. But then it was quite curious. It was really evident to me in the next several years, I'd go back to Washington frequently, but many of those old friends who were closeted then dropped me. Once I became more known, particularly as I became more known as a gay activist, you know, it was like they forgot they ever knew me or ever friends. And that just kind of reinforced that I had made the right decision.
Have you ever wondered what would have happened if the Harvey Milk's assassination had happened before you came out, how you would have taken it?
It might have prompted me to then come out. I mean, it might have had a similar kind of effect, sort of propel me forward to, you know, another step.
You write about the beginning, those early days of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, and how shockingly quickly things moved.
They did. I was a volunteer copy editor briefly at the gay paper in New York, the New York Native, that was the very first place ever to write about the epidemic. So I was kind of paying attention from the beginning, as well as having symptoms. We didn't know if it was AIDS. That wasn't that clear at the time. But they were the year before, I was going to school at Columbia by then, and I'd ended up at Sloan Kettering with a concern that I might have a lymphoma. Looking back, we think that was probably my seroconversion sickness. But in the summer of 1981, when the New York Times wrote an article that described symptoms that a number of people who died had shared early on, swollen lymph glands, night sweats, weight loss, I had all those. So I kind of felt some kinship with this and was very attentive early. But, you know, at that time, people with AIDS were people who were very, very sick, who were, you know, weeks, if not days away from death. They looked sick. They were clearly, you know, at a very acute stage. But my doctor, and I think a number of doctors said this, that yes, I had swollen lymph glands. I had some, you know, measures of immune suppression, but I still had an immune system. You know, it was explained to us people with AIDS didn't have an immune system, so that one could almost look at the symptoms I had as a good thing, as something that was reassuring.
You stress in the book, too, that a turning point in our understanding of AIDS and the epidemic itself was when the medical industry essentially allowed the people who are suffering from AIDS to participate in their own healing.
Yeah, I'd frame it differently. Rather than the medical industry allowing it, it was when people with AIDS organized themselves and asserted their right to a collective voice. In the summer of 1983 in Denver, a group of people, the first time a group of people with AIDS from around the country ever gathered together to strategize politically, and they'd never even met each other before. And they wrote a manifesto, the Denver Principles, that's sort of the foundation of the self-empowerment movement. And it was historic. It was at a conference, and they were recognized there with a long-standing ovation. It was very moving. But actually, that's the first time in the history of humanity when people who shared a disease organized to assert their right to a collective voice in the policy development and service delivery that would so profoundly affect their lives. And it's had an influence now far beyond the AIDS epidemic. It has really influenced patient advocacy and activism in breast cancer, multiple sclerosis, and mental health issues. So that was a very important moment, and it was that concept of the self-empowerment, of we could be each other's experts and support. And we went out and created a whole network of service delivery organizations because the existing service delivery healthcare system didn't serve us. We launched research organizations, buyers clubs, media. That was very important AIDS activism. And it preceded what most people think of when you talk about AIDS activism in the 1980s. We talk about AIDS activism in the 1980s, people think of ACT UP and the street demonstrations, the theatrical protests and the anger and fury of that, which I was very much a part of as well. But this activism, the self-empowerment activism that preceded that is, I think, an important and understudied early part of the epidemic.
And that suggests organization within the LGBT community to talk about this and to come out and to be open and honest about what we are all facing.
And, of course, AIDS was synonymous, and AIDS activism was synonymous with LGBT community activism at the time. It wasn't, distinct the way it is today. But it was at a curious time in the gay movement that it started out really as a sexual liberation movement that came out of the 60s. But in the mid to late 70s, we started to get our first electoral victories, which were non-discrimination ordinances passed in Dade County and in St. Paul and Wichita, I think, in Eugene, Oregon. But then they quickly were being overturned. And what had been a sexual liberation movement began a shift to becoming a political reform movement focused on this concept of equality, which was something very different. A sexual liberation movement fundamentally was, we're liberated. You know, a political reform movement was sort of predicated on, we're really no different than you and we need equal rights. So it was, you know, more about the acceptance, the place at the table. It was very conscious of a public image. Which I think made it very difficult for the gay community leadership at the time to be honest about gay men's sexuality. And that also played a role early in the epidemic.
Talking with Sean Stroob, who is the author of Body Counts, today on The State of Things. It is a memoir of his activism, sex, and survival, as it says in the subtitle. Talk about that activism, because it was dramatic, including one of the more dramatic episodes right here in the state of North Carolina.
Right, and I think it was 23 years ago last week, maybe. So ACT UP, some of the actions we undertook, as we called them, you know, there were the big public demonstrations, and then there were actions. We sort of operated like in cells because sometimes they, you know, skirted legal issues and could get people in trouble. So we had a group of seven of us who planned an action to, we really were seeking to make fun of U.S. Senator Jesse Helms, you know, if his action on the epidemic in the 1980s and early 90s wasn't so tragic, it would be a joke. And so what we decided we would do is create a gigantic condom made out of parachute material and snugly fit it over his two-story brick colonial home in Arlington, Virginia. And on the side of it, it said, protect yourself from unsafe politics. Jesse Helms is more dangerous than a virus. And it was quite a feat. We had to take pictures of the house and translate that into measurements. We had to find the company that would fabricate this thing. We pulled up in front of the house early one morning in a U-Haul truck. We had practiced, so we knew who. We had only a few minutes before we knew the police would get there. We had found out the average response time in that neighborhood. And Peter Staley and I were the fastest on the ladder. So we were the ones who climbed up onto the roof and started unfurling it. And our comrades were starting a portable generator and blowers to inflate it and pulling it down with guy wires. And the first police officer got there when it was about, you know, I would say semi-tumescent. And and ultimately, it was almost 35 feet in the air with a reservoir tip and was kind of a fun action. You know, I also write about other actions that were more intense and more emotional, and including the most controversial action that ACT UP ever undertook, which was at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, that involved interruption of a mass, which was very controversial within ACT UP. But through the, you know, hindsight, it, I think, is really understood as a very powerful and important moment. The 25th anniversary of that action is coming up this December.
We have only about 30 seconds left, but where are we today? Has all of that action led to a new and better understanding?
We have made dramatic biomedical advances, so the consequences of HIV transmission today are profoundly different. A person expects to lead a normal lifespan. We are still failing at prevention, and stigma is growing and worse than ever, and we are not taking that and taking the steps necessary to reverse it.
I'm talking with veteran AIDS activist Sean Stroob. He's talking about his new book, a memoir called Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. Sean, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You will hear Sean read from his new memoir at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham tonight at 7 o'clock. You can find out more information at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up, the music of Delta Ray. Stay tuned.